The Thanksgiving movie releases have provided us with a cornucopia of cinematic offerings to choose from. Do we have a lot to be thankful for? Or have we been served up a batch of celluloid turkeys? On the next Central Standard, we'll check out the current crop from Hollywood and abroad and let you know what's worth your time and money and what you should avoid at all costs. We'll also take a look at what's right for the family audience and what fare is for adults only. Plus, we want your feedback on what you've seen, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Join me, Russ Simmons, and my fellow film critics on the next Central Standard. That's coming up right after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City, and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Russ Simmons, sitting in the host seat this morning, which means it's movie day here on Central Standard. We're going to be taking a look at some movies that have opened up over the last month or so, and we do have a lot of Thanksgiving leftovers, and some of them are tasty and some of them are not so much. So we'll go over the films, the good ones, and even the turkeys here for our Thanksgiving feast. And I'm with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM, and this morning on the panel I'm joined by...
Good morning, Marie Asner with PhantomTollbooth.org and OnAirPrep.com, a radio syndicate.
And another good morning from Tom Poe, a film professor at UMKC.
Welcome to you both. I know that this is kind of a mixed bag, but a very interesting collection of movies. So we want you to join in on the conversation. What new films have you seen in the last month? Which ones are you still thinking about today and why? So join the conversation at 816-235-2888. You can also tweet us at KCURCST, or you can even send an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. We definitely want to hear from you. Well, let's start out with the film that's burning up the box office, so to speak. It's called The Hunger Games: Catching Fire.
For fans of The Hunger Games, this is the second book in the trilogy. The third one is going to be coming out about a year from now. It follows the adventures of Jennifer Lawrence as Katniss Everdeen. Now, if you have not read this and you go to this as your first film, it's the second in the series, you can follow the story along fairly well. It's a different universe, a different time period, a different situation in which there are 12 districts, and the premise is that food is the essential thing, and so we have the Hunger Games, and there's only one person who comes out of this alive, and their district is the one that gets the food. So we continue now into the second one, where Katniss and her friend Peeta have won the games, and they're on a tour, and she is the heroine of the people now. There's rebellion in the works, and the evil president Snow, Donald Sutherland, who could be twirling his mustache, is there in the background. And so he comes up with an idea to get rid of her, and that is to have the past winners have a game, and then there's only one winner there. And they're transported to a tropical island, and then from then on we have people fighting to survive. It's very inventive, and it carries you right through into what would be the third book, the third chapter. A year from now. I think Jennifer Lawrence makes a very good Katniss Everdeen, but Suzanne Collins, who wrote the series, must have had a lot of fun choosing these names because, you know, Katniss could be Catherine or Kate or even Catnip, but we have Katniss. And Everdeen, I keep wanting to say Evergreen. And we have Woody Harrelson as Hey Mitch. It could be Haymaker or anything like that. So I think she made a list down of the common names and then started substituting, and I thought that was kind of clever. Plenty of action, inventive sequences. I'm giving this a 3.
Tom?
This is, as Marie said, the second installment of what had started off as a very, very popular sort of trilogy, I suppose, as it'll turn out. But I'm really pleased with this second installment. I was not all that impressed with the first one. It had its real strengths for what it was, but I thought as far as the direction and art design, it was a little bit clunky. But the subtitle of this second Hunger Games is called Catching Fire, and I think that's very appropriate because for me, it's the second installment that really does catch fire. I think primarily because Jennifer Lawrence's character deepens really beautifully. There's a sadness and stoicism in her performance. And I think that the second in the script, it really starts exploring in a much more serious, meaningful way the deeper sort of psychological themes and political themes. It's Jennifer Lawrence and Donald Sutherland, though, that I think the play against each other that really is what gives the emotional center to the film. My feeling is that the first half is just really terrific, and then it gets into the games themselves, and the games turn out not to be as interesting as I think the sort of psychological complexities that set the film up. But I think for the kind of action-adventure, a young adult type of tentpole movie, boy, this is a good one. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go all the way to 4 stars.
Marie, you had something else you wanted to add?
Yes, I just wanted to add there are some costumes here that deliberately catch on fire. Do not try this at home.
Yeah. You know, I tend to agree with you, Tom. I thought this was very well done. It is, I think, a notch above the first installment as well. The contest is not over, but I tell you, Jennifer Lawrence is the clear winner.
Yes.
Because she carries this movie. She carries this franchise. She gives a spot-on performance as Katniss Everdeen. And it's a fierce, confident performance. That last frame where we see her expression tells all. Oh. And it's just read it in her face. And so I thought it was a terrific movie. So I'm going to give it a 4 as well. So let's, even though we had 1-3 between us, let's give it a, go ahead and give it a 4 if you don't mind, Marie.
Yeah,
for
that's fine.
For The Hunger Games: Catching Fire, and it's rated PG-13, but I want to caution people, there is a lot of violence, and there is some controversy over whether or not some of these films that have a lot of violence should be rated R, so just be aware of that before you make your choice as to what you're going to see. But speaking of ratings controversy, let's move on to another film that certainly is generating a lot. It's called Blue is the Warmest Color. It was the big winner at the Cannes Film Festival, winning the Palme d'Or for its director and the 2 stars of the film. Tom?
Yes. It's not since probably 1973 when Bernardo Bertolucci's Last Tango in Paris came out, has an art film received so much critical praise and generated even more sort of scandal and controversy. In part, that's because of the story itself, which comes from a graphic novel about two young women who fall passionately in love. So on the one side, there's a lot of controversy because it's got very graphic lesbian sex scenes, one that goes on for like 6 minutes or so. And the author, original author, has criticized the film because they didn't employ lesbian actresses. That's an interesting discussion we don't have time to go into. But in fact, when it comes to representations of LGBT folks, it does seem like that probably in film at this point, you've got to be straight to play a gay character. But we'll leave that controversy aside. Then one of the actresses, Leah Seydoux, who plays Emma, complained very publicly that the director was a bully and that she had been mistreated and felt exploited. Then some feminist critics have complained that, in fact, the sex scenes aren't very realistic because this heterosexual director who is getting off on watching girls at play. And the two actresses really don't know anything about how real women would make love to each other. But leave all of that aside. And if you can, I recommend you just go watch the movie as a movie because I think it's stunning. It's long. It's complex. It's like 3 hours. But, you know, it really isn't all that much about the sex scenes.
No.
It's really about the relationship and the meaning of the relationship of sex and love, and particularly your first time to encounter that, and can it last? And I don't know of a film that has such beautiful acting, that's so realistic, that so deeply explores that very human question. The funny thing is, because it's a French film, this is more a film that Truffaut would have made than sort of a shocking, pornographic, scandalous film. I just think it's beautiful, and I think it's going to be a film which will be, last through the ages, and the performances are just stunning. So I'm going to give it 4 stars.
You know, I think that the controversy is you know, some people are calling it a masterpiece. Some people are calling it pornography. I guess the truth probably really lies somewhere in between. But the fact of the matter is that this movie would work without those sex scenes. Cut out all those sex scenes, and you have a really poignant love story with tremendous acting. You're right. Lea Seydoux and particularly Adele Oxycopoulos are just terrific in this movie. And yes, perhaps the director, Abdellatif Kechiche, has exploited them. I think that's a matter of personal interpretation. But the resulting film is still a very realistic and heartbreaking account of that minefield of young love. And it really, really hits home. And I think it's easily one of the best films of the year.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the French title actually is The Life of Adele, Chapter 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. And I wish that they had used that in this country, because I think that gives us more of the sense that this is really the life of a young girl. And when you say Chapters 1 and 2, it just leaves open the question for the audience as to,
what
are the next chapters of her life going to be?
Right.
That's not asking for a sequel. I think it's just explaining that we need to see this as a coming of age. Oh, wonderful exploration of sex and love. And when it comes to pornography, of course, since cave paintings in the ancient world, they're not always two different things.
Right. Marie?
Both of you hit on what I was going to be talking about, too, is that this is a story, and it could be done with two women. It could be done with two men. It could be done with a man and a woman. It's exploring sex for the first time. It's one person who's maturing into sex. It's another person who's there, who sees this person and is helping them through this. There are side characters that are very good that assist the young person. Who, and I'm not going to try and pronounce the names. Russ was brave to tackle the names. Through this process, almost like a Greek chorus, every time she has a question, she asks somebody, and they come up with an answer to help her. I'm going to give it a 3, and I thought that it was interesting and well done.
I thought it was very good. I'm going to give it a 4.5. I'm even going to go a bit beyond that. My only criticism, I think it was a bit too long and a little repetitious. That's really the only criticism I have of it. And as I said before, if you took out the sex scenes, it wouldn't matter. The film would work without them. And that's the important point, I think. So shall we average it out to a 4 between the three of us for Blue is the Warmest Color? Rated NC-17, folks. So it does deserve that rating. If you've seen it, what do you think? What films have you seen in the last month or so? Join the conversation by calling us at 816-235-2888, or you can always tweet us at KCURCST. And speaking of which, we did get an email at centralstandard@kcur.org from Wendell, who wanted to know, is it too late to talk about 12 Years a Slave? It's lasted with me. It was intense and highly emotional, but definitely not for the squeamish. I think we can both, all three of us can touch on it real quick. We did talk about it the last time we were on, but I think it's excellent films. Maybe the best film of the year.
I'm inclined to be thinking it's the best film of the year.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an exceptional film. It's not for the squeamish, I'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. Be aware of that when you attend it. And I'm going to refer back to Blue is the warmest color. Blue is a person's hair color in here, for reference.
You know, I would just add about 12 Years a Slave. It's not only an excellent film, but I think it's an important film.
It is, and that makes it gives it a notch, you know, above some of the other fare that's out there. You know, I think Gravity is a terrific film as well, but I think you have to give, if you're going to have to choose a film to see, if you can handle the violence, then I think 12 Years a Slave is important because of the historical context as well. Let's move on and talk about another film that came out back on November 22nd. It's a drama based on a true story. It's called Dallas Buyers Club. Tom, do you want to take the lead on that one?
I will. Oh, it's 1985 at the beginning of the age of AIDS in America, and this movie is a dramatization of a true story in which Matthew McConaughey plays a redneck, homophobic Texas cowboy named Ron Woodruff. Who gets the unbelievable news that, of all people, he has AIDS and can expect to live maybe 30 days. Refusing to go down without a fight, he joins up with a flamboyant drag queen played by Jared Leto to circumvent the sort of non-action of the government and health community and start smuggling in alternate drugs to prolong his life. And in doing so, ends up prolonging the lives of hundreds of others. What makes this movie so special are the performances by McConaughey and Jared Leto.
Right.
Neither are recognizable from their usual screen personas. And Leto's a real revelation. She sure is pretty. And what a year it's been for McConaughey. From a sexy stripper in Magic Mike to playing JFK and the butler to his wonderful character in Mud. And now his transformation into a real, if entertaining, gutsy jerk. And he is a jerk. And it's not a movie cliche where this is going to be a jerk with a heart of gold. But his lesson is that sometimes God uses jerks. It's an important story to tell, and I think it's beautifully told. So I'm going to give it 4 stars.
Murray?
Matthew McConaughey was in Kansas City about 10 years ago promoting the film Sahara, and he looked lean and mean at that time, but he dropped about 40 pounds for this role, and he really is lean as Ron Woodruff, who is fighting this disease. And the FDA has an approved drug, I think it was AZT, that they said will help this in enormous quantities, but it really makes the person ill instead. So that's why he starts exploring other methods of treatment. And so he goes to Mexico and other countries to find things. And the Dallas Buyers Club is designed to help people. You have a certain amount of money that you pay every month. And then for that, you get the drugs that you need. And all of a sudden, people are getting better. And wow, the FDA does not like this. So we have a culmination here of a lawsuit. And I won't go any further and spoil anything. The performances are wonderful. Matthew McConaughey is very good. Jennifer Garner, as a sympathetic doctor, is quite good. Dennis O'Hare is the opposite doctor who would throw everybody in jail. But it's Jared Leto, who you don't recognize as the character or the person named Rayon. And I would give this, I'd give this 4 stars.
You know, this movie falls flat, completely flat without those two performances.
Uh-huh.
But
yes.
Thanks to them, it really does work.
Mm-hmm.
And it does also have a kind of an abrupt denouement, you know, so all of a sudden it's over and wait a minute, what happened? So it's not a perfect film by any stretch of the imagination from a filmmaking point of view, but it's a compelling story, it's an important story, and it's beautifully acted. I'll give it a 3.5, so shall we say 4 overall for Dallas Buyers Club, rated R. And let's touch on another film that opened back on November 24th. Marie, this is, as Monty Python used to say, and now for something completely different, Vince Vaughn stars in the sentimental comedy. It's called Delivery Man.
Well, Delivery Man is a remake of the Canadian film called Starbuck, which came out just about a year ago. And it's about a man who, during his college days, went to a sperm bank and donated sperm for money. And here it is. 20 years later, and all of a sudden he finds out that he's actually fathered 500 children. And they have a class action lawsuit looking for the person whose code name was Starbuck in order to say, you know, Daddy, I'm here. And he's, you know, shocked at this. And the basic premise is that the privacy of the clinic has been is gone, actually, for a certain period of time, and he's in danger of people knowing who he is. And so we go back and forth about him, and he starts investigating the children and so on. The first film did this so well, Starbuck. It was subtitled in French, and the actor, Daniel Hurd, did it so much better than Vince Vaughn does. This is a Vince Vaughn movie, and he stands there, and the camera's on him. He recites his lines, and then we go to another scene with Vince Vaughn in it. And the flavor of this film, I believe, is lost. So I would say go back and see the first Starbuck, which I think I rated 4. And this one is, for Vince Vaughn fans, if you like anything he's in, barely a 2.
Well, you know, I think you might be being a little hard on it, Marie. I wonder if you would have thought that had you not seen the original. Because let's face it, the vast majority of the audience out there will never have seen Starbuck. So I do agree with you. I do think Starbuck, the original, was better. But, you know, this movie was a sweet, sentimental story. I kind of liked Vince Vaughn. But I thought the supporting actors in some cases were actually better than they were in the French version, particularly the actor who played his lawyer, you know, kind of the...
Oliver Pratt, I think his name is?
Chris Pratt.
Chris Pratt, okay.
Right. He's very funny, and I think he was actually better than the person that was in Starbuck. But, you know, that's a small matter. I just thought it was a sweet story, so I'll give it a 3. So you said 2.5?
2.
Okay, so we'll average it out to 2.5 for Delivery Man, rated PG-13. And let's talk quickly also about a film that came out back on the 22nd, which is about the famous poet Allen Ginsberg, and it's called Kill Your Darlings.
Yes, in 1944, four very lost boys who were students at Columbia University met up and created the Beat Movement and changed the world. This is the story of their very beginnings, and it's not a pretty story, but rather a murder mystery. And this is based very much on sort of real history, and I know that history pretty well since I teach the Beats as a part of my courses at UMKC. And it seems to be pretty much accurate as to what really took place. Of course, much of the notice about this film is because it stars Daniel Radcliffe as Allen Ginsberg. And certainly, probably the controversy kind of gets stirred is that he has at least one very graphic same-sex love scene in the film. And Radcliffe is very good and looks so much like the young Ginsberg that it's almost uncanny. Ben Foster has the young William Burroughs down pat. And at least because I got to know Burroughs in his old age, Foster's performance seems just like I would have imagined William Burroughs to be as a young man. But to me, the biggest revelation in the film is Dane DeHaan as a maddening, self-absorbed, damaged student named Lucien. And Lucien Carr really was, as Ginsberg once said, the glue that held the Beats together. He ended up killing another one of their friends who had been either a lover or stalker. And that was greatly controversial at that time and still is among historians of the whole Beat movement. But DeHaan, I think, steals in many ways the movie. Boy, he's good. And I'm looking forward to his future as an actor. I think this is really a terrific, compelling, beautifully made indie biopic. It's a subject that I'm already fascinated by. So if you're really into literary biopics about the Beats, I think it's a terrific time at the movies. So I'm going to give it 4 stars.
Marie?
Well, I agree with Tom on this one. And as much as we would talk about the male stars in here, we've got 3 female stars in here who do very well, too. We've got Jennifer Jason Leigh. And when was the last time I saw her on the screen playing Naomi, who is quite an unstable person? And we have Edie, who is played by Elizabeth Olsen, giving another kind of understated performance. She's picking her roles carefully, this young actress. And we have Lucien's mother, Kira Sedgwick, who comes up with some unusual information without giving anything away at a certain time, which kind of reveals something. And so I'm going to give this probably 3.
Okay, so we have a 4 from Tom and a 3 from Marie, so we'll average it out to a 3.5 for Kill Your Darlings, rated R. And I think even though it may not still be showing in the Kansas City area, there is a documentary I think we should touch on because it will be available soon on DVD if it's not yet. And that's a controversial documentary called God Loves Uganda. And I know you caught that, Tom, so fill us in.
Yes. This is a film about evangelical Christian groups who in some ways, because they're feeling like they're losing the cultural wars here in the United States, have turned their attention to the continent of Africa, where they've been very, very active in converting. In fact, folks to a very conservative evangelical sort of form of Christianity. And what's the great impact that's had on particularly increasing rather horrendous persecutions of LGBT people in Africa, because that becomes one of the big selling points, is that that's the way you show your chief devotion and loyalty to sort of God, is to stop sort of homosexuality. Why the documentary is important, I think, particularly to local audiences, is that what's very prominently figured is the work of the International House of Prayer, which is headquartered here in Grandview, Missouri, and the powerful impact that particular group has been having, particularly on the persecution of LGBT people in Africa. So it's an important documentary. It's no longer showing, but hopefully it'll come out on DVD. And I think that it's something that one ought to be aware of.
And if you were to give it a rating from 1 to 5, what would you
give it? I'd give it 3.
Three, that's 3 for God Loves Uganda. That's not rated. If you were to give it a rating as far as the violence or whatever graphic content or whatever it would deserve, if it's an MPAA rating, what would it be, Tom?
Oh, there's nothing in it that would be disturbing on that kind of level of either sex or violence.
Okay.
So it's a safe film.
Okay. And once again, that's called God Loves Uganda. And just before we take a break, I'm going to quickly cover another film that opened this one back on the 27th of November. And it's Spike Lee's remake of the award-winning and ultra-violent South Korean revenge flick Old Boy. And sadly, it's a disappointment. Josh Brolin plays a man who gets kidnapped and held hostage alone in a motel room for 20 years. Once released, he tries to solve the mystery of his baffling incarnation, and he attempts to get even. And it's sadistic and repelling, and it commands your attention, but it does so like an ugly car wreck. So I'm going to give Old Boy a rating of 2, and it's R-rated for violence, and boy, does it earn that rating. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have a few announcements, and then we'll also be covering some of the other movies that have opened up over the last month or so. And we want your feedback. You can give us a call, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCURCST, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Russ Simmons, and I'm joined today by my fellow movie critics Tom Poe and Marie Asner. And we're covering those Thanksgiving leftovers that are still in the cinemas around the Kansas City metropolitan area. And we want to hear from you. What new films have you seen? What has been on your mind? What is it that you're thinking about? Give us a call, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCURCST. And you can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And have a number of announcements that I want to quickly make before we jump back into our reviews. The Kansas City Public Library is screening the classic 1932 gangster flick Scarface at 1:30 p.m. on Saturday the 7th, and it's part of a Muni the Magnificent series of films starring Paul Muni, the Oscar winner, one of the most acclaimed actors of Hollywood's golden era. And upcoming favorites will include I'm a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, The Story of Louis Pasteur, and The Life of Emile Zola. He was big on those biographies. And they're also doing Hollywood's Greatest Year, 1939, a series of films from that part of the golden era. So beginning on the 29th of December and running through 2014, the Plaza branch of the library will screen classic films from that unique year. And upcoming titles include Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz, Stagecoach, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Wuthering Heights. So you can find out more information on that, of course, at kcur.org. And also the Tivoli Performing Arts Series is continuing with the La Scala Operas of Milan's performance of La Traviata. And that's going to be a live broadcast, a simulcast on Saturday, December 7th. That's tomorrow at noon. And they're also upcoming the Bolshoi Ballet's performance of Sleeping Beauty on the 15th, as well as the National Theater event 50 Years on Stage, which is December 14th, and the Royal Shakespeare Company's version of Richard II starring David Tennant on the 29th. And also, you can find information on some classic movies that are showing for Christmas time on our website. The B&B Theaters will have a retro night series that will include White Christmas, and that's December 10th and the 12th. And then also the Cinemark Classic Series will have National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, as well as It's a Wonderful Life. And you can find information about all these and much, much more at kcur.org. So let's pick up where we left off and talk about some of the movies that have opened up over the last month or so. And I think maybe it's particularly fitting, since it's so cold outside, that we talk about a new Disney film. It's called Frozen. Marie?
Well, I almost didn't want to go to this one because The title is the same as a horror film that came out last year about people that are trapped on a ski lift, and as night closes in on them and they start dropping off into the snow, something is waiting for them. And then I thought, Disney is remaking this horror film? Wait a minute. But no, this is a remake of The Snow Queen, beautifully done, wonderful animation. Now, I did not see this in 3D, and I was satisfied with the way everything was. It was nice and almost looked like 3D, so you don't have to see it in 3D. It's a story about two sisters, and once again, we have two sisters, we have siblings, and we have two more princesses to add to the Disney line. We have Elsa and Anna, and one of them has a power that she doesn't want. It's to freeze things with her hands, and she has to keep herself under control all the time, and when the secret comes out, she runs away. And there's a chase scene there after her where the village is almost like after Frankenstein going up into the mountains. So I'm saying that even though this film is rated PG, might be a little intense for the princesses under the age of perhaps 7. And so we have one sister rescuing the other. And the songs are very well done, especially one about freedom. The voices are, Idina Menzel. Idina Menzel is the older sister, and Kristen Bell, beautiful voice for the younger sister. And then we have the usual sidekicks. We have a reindeer and a talking snowman, which could have been eliminated. I'm going to give this 3.5.
Tom?
Oh, I'm going to get euphoric here. I just found this such a bright and shiny Christmas present from Disney Studios that is rather loosely based on Hans Christian Andersen's classic tale, The Snow Queen. But it's probably more Disney than it is Hans Christian Andersen. But for a Broadway musical geek like me, this is just a dream cast. Idina Menzel, of course, was the Wicked Witch in Wicked. And in fact, the name Frozen sort of clues us in that the template for, I think, this movie is the musical Wicked, with the characters representing sort of the good and, or at least the emotional sides of almost like sister characters. And then you've got Jonathan Groff, who originated Spring Awakening, and Josh Gad, who originated the Book of Mormon. This is a terrific musical. I think the songs are really great. And not surprisingly, because, in fact, they're written by the folks who wrote the music for the Book of Mormon. So this is a real Broadway show. That doesn't surprise me either, because it's more than a guess. I think it's a promise that the Disney company knows that what the next step is, the mounting of Frozen as the next big,
Wicked,
huge family Broadway hit. And I think it will be a hit. I just think it's a beautiful film to watch. It's a good story. Fine music. I tell you, though, I think the first 35 to 40 minutes, which sets the whole thing up, is some of the most beautiful filmmaking imaginable. Then it becomes sort of, I think, with the snowman, Disney-like. But boy, when it's really running full steam, this is just, I think, a great film. I'm going to give it certainly a 4.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Tom. I enjoyed this film thoroughly, and visually it's stunning. And I thought the songs, although I didn't find them that memorable, I did think they were good. The singing is terrific. The last time that Disney adapted a Hans Christian Andersen story for the big screen was The Little Mermaid, and it did okay, too. I don't think this one's quite on a par with The Little Mermaid, but it's awfully good. And I think that the family audience, there's probably not a better choice for a full family audience in theaters right now than Frozen, because some of the other films might be a little too violent or a little too silly. Free Birds, for example, the Thanksgiving bird movie, is just a little too silly. However, this one just hits all the right notes, I thought. So I'm going to give it a 4 as well. Marie?
Yes, and running along with this is a 7-minute Disney cartoon called Get a Horse, in which it uses old footage of Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse, Clarabelle the cow, trying to go on a hayride, and Peg Leg Pete is after them. And the voice of Walt Disney is actually the voice of Mickey Mouse in this. So that runs along with him. It's like 2 for the price of 1.
I agree. That was delightful, too. So yes. I suspect that it might get an Oscar nomination for Best Animated Short. So it's just a little added bonus for you there when you go see the movie. So that's Frozen rated PG, and I think we're going to since Tom and I both gave it a 4, and Marie was the lone voice at a 3, So you're good with going for the four. Okay. So we'll average it out to a four for Frozen. And, of course, it's visually spectacular. It's wildly colorful. And it's a treat, I think, for the whole family. We did have someone called in to ask us. And, of course, everyone has Nelson Mandela on their mind, the passing of the great leader from South Africa. When is the movie going to open about his life, and have we seen it? And I've seen it. I don't know if you guys had a chance to watch it yet. It doesn't open until Christmas Day, but it will open wide in the Kansas City area on Christmas Day, so it'll give you an opportunity to catch up. And it is a direct, straight-ahead biography of his life based on his autobiography, and it's very faithful and earnest, and I won't get into review until later, but if you're interested in knowing the history of Nelson Mandela, then this movie will fill those gaps.
And Idris Elba plays Mandela.
Correct.
In the film?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so let's move on and talk about another literary adaptation. This one's called The Book Thief, and boy, this is a really popular book. It's about a young girl who is taken in by a foster family in Nazi Germany. And at the time of the Kristallnacht and the book burnings and so on, and she learns to love literature, and also she learns tolerance and love when they take in and hide a Jewish hostage in their basement, hide him from the Nazi authorities. I did not read the book that this is based on, which I understand is beloved, and to me, I felt that this was ham-fisted, and it just didn't quite work. It seemed artificial. There was an artificial sheen that was throughout this film. It might work for some people, but I think that the artificiality is what kind of ruined it for me. What did you think, Tom?
I totally agree. I haven't read the book either, though I know how popular it is as a young adult novel. But, you know, I really suspect that this kind of material worked better as a novel than a movie because they're such different art forms. Film is so literal. And this movie makes use of the Holocaust as a setting for this intimate, sort of sentimental coming-of-age story that starts to make me feel a little uncomfortable. Something like a high school production of The Diary of Anne Frank can suddenly, at this point in time, feel a little bit too sweet. Allowing us to sort of not really confront the true horrors of the Holocaust. And I think in a novel, this sort of narration of a character who is the voice of death just probably works on the written page, but in the literal sort of art of movie making, that just really didn't work. And especially when he says, I found this story worthy of my particular attention, as you're seeing hundreds of Jews being taken away to death camps. There was just something uncomfortable about the film being too cozy for me. So it's well acted. Jeffrey Rush, Emily Watson, and a young Canadian actress, Sophie Nielsen. It looks good. It's fine. It's just, I don't think it works.
No.
I'm going to give it 2.5 stars.
And Marie?
I just wanted to add something. I have not seen the film, but last night I was listening to a radio sports talk program in which the gentlemen are always so familiar with statistics, and they were giving their best and worst films of the year, and they put Book Thief, both of them, on top as their best film.
Interesting. And in a timely manner, we have Chandler calling in from Prairie Village about this very topic. Hi, Chandler. Chandler, are you there? Chandler? Hello? Do we have Chandler on the air?
Hello?
Oh, hi. Is this Chandler?
Hi. Sorry. Yes.
Well, welcome aboard.
I was just wondering, you guys talked about Catching Fire earlier, and I read those books before I went to go see the movies, and I was wondering if you would recommend reading the Book Thief before you went to go see the movie.
I suppose I would recommend reading the book, period, and not necessarily seeing the movie.
Okay.
because I understand, you know, from the other people that I've talked to who have read the book, that it's quite delightful. I can only speak from the movie, and the movie was just okay.
I agree. I haven't actually read the book, but I do find, in fact, these sort of plot lines of the film confusing. And I think it has the same issues, I think, of the movie as maybe Harry Potter does. When you're making a movie, a book that's so beloved, so much of the audience is going to sort of be sitting there wanting to make sure that every beloved character and plot point is covered. And I found it as a viewer that hadn't read the book, but sometimes all of that gets very muddled in my mind. And I kind of go, I think I'd have to go back and read the book to quite figure out what's going on. And
yeah.
Especially if you didn't see the first Hunger Games,
right.
You'd better probably read the book or at least watch the first Hunger Games before you go to see the second installment.
Right. That is an advantage I think that I had as well in the first Hunger Games as I had read the book. I did not read Catching Fire, however, and I didn't have any problems. But maybe it's because I had the backstory all learned before we even went into the film. So once again, The Book Thief was rated PG-13, and we're giving that a rating of 2.5. And I think here's something that I think we all three liked better. It's a delightful story with Judi Dench as a woman who has found that she's going to find the young child that she gave up for adoption back in the 50s, and now as an older woman takes that trek with a journalist named Steve Coogan, and the movie is called Philomena. Marie?
Well, I was disappointed in this, and Tom and I were talking about this beforehand, and so Judi Dench, I thought, kind of sleepwalked through her performance here, and there's so much rich material in the background about searching for her son after all these years and the information that she finds out, and she's paired with Steve Coogan, who is a comic. And the first half of the film, he's got some coy little comments that he throws her way, and you start thinking this is going to be a bit of a sarcastic comedy. And in the last half, she seems to kind of go into the background. There's just no reaction. And he comes to the forefront and gives a good, solid performance. And so for that reason, I was disappointed. And the basic thing is she has a daughter who suddenly disappears halfway through the movie, by the way. And the daughter is helping her find this lost son who she finally admits she had. She was a young unwed mother and went to a Catholic charity house, I guess you'd call it, to have the child. And then the child was given up for adoption. And then she lost track of it. And 50 years later, we've got the search. And I thought it could have been so much more. It seemed like such rich material. But Judi Dench, to me, just kind of failed a little bit here, and I'm going to give it, I'll push it a 3 for Steve Coogan.
I have a different take on this and liked it a great deal, though I could understand Marie's feelings, and I think that they're very interesting to sort of talk about why a person might have that reaction. It's based, of course, on a true story, and you could say that it ends up becoming just a simple kind of character study. In fact, the sort of everyday sort of beaten down woman and then the sort of very ambitious BBC reporter that's wanting to just make a human interest story. So that's his basic motives at the beginning. I think what's really fascinating and good about the movie, though, is in fact the way sort of roles kind of change and personalities shift. I think what is disturbing about Judi Dench is that our impression of Judi Dench is she's such a strong character and her characters are such strong women that it bothers us to see her suddenly looking kind of old and dowdy. And I think, though, that that's intended. Mm-hmm. I think that that's what makes it kind of a brave performance on Judi Dench's part, because what comes to happen, I think, is that our cocky reporter starts, in fact, becoming softer and having more questions about if it's ethical to be
right.
making her just a human interest story. And Judi Dench's character turns out to be emerging as a woman who, in fact, is actually the strongest of the two. And so I think that disturbing part about Judi Dench is playing pathetic. Isn't it a shame what actresses as they get older are given roles where they have to be pathetic? But by the end, I think all that gets reversed in an interesting way, and that's why I really like the film, and I'm going to give it 4 stars.
I'm right there with you. I think that Steve Coogan, I think you nailed it. His is the character that evolves, and it's really interesting to see that evolution. And then also the revelation of mm-hmm. Judi Dench's undercurrent of strength that she's had throughout all of it. But there's a sly wit to this movie. It's very well written by Steve Coogan. He gave himself a nice part And I thought it was a very sweet-natured and very effective movie. So I'm giving it a 4 as well. Did you say 3 or 3.5?
Yeah, 3, because the daughter disappeared halfway through and they never did bring her back.
And that's Philomena, rated PG-13. Let's talk quickly about another film that opened on the 27th. It's about a state just north of us. It's Alexander Payne's kind of salute to his home state of Nebraska. And this is a road movie starring Bruce Dern as a man who's suffering from dementia and his son, played by Will Forte from Saturday Night Live, acquiesces and reluctantly takes him on a trip from Montana to Nebraska in order to collect a quote-unquote million-dollar prize, which he thinks he's won. Of course, it's a advertising come-on, and he has not won the money. But he decides to take his dad anyway, realizing that this might be a chance for them to bond. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. And there's a lot of sly humor, wit. There's an undercurrent of sadness as well and melancholy. I think maybe melancholy might be the word that best sums up this film. Beautifully shot in glorious black and white. And it's kind of a sweet-natured movie. Now, it may be a little too slow for some viewers, but I think it's a very nice tribute to Alexander Payne's home state, and I'm going to give it a 4.
You know, the way that they made this film is it was originally shot in color, and then they drained all the color out to give us a black-and-white movie, and that's kind of a metaphor, I think, for actually what the film is really about, this view of sort of the Midwest that was once so vital and has now been drained so much of life as the characters are. Bruce Dern as the cantankerous drunken old coot is just terrific. I think Will Forte is a revelation. And the actress that plays Bruce Dern's wife just gives a great performance. When I walked out of the theater, I kind of initially was thinking, it's a really good character study, but a little bit of a downer, melancholy. But then, you know, this is a film that the next day you're still thinking about it, and after that you're still thinking about it. And then it occurs to me that Alexander Payne's films about Schmidt, the descendants, so often explore the meaning of family, and in fact how that binds us in ways which both hurt and heal. You know, the work that reminded me most of Nebraska is probably Don Quixote.
There you go. Yeah, makes sense. And so, how many out of
4
5?
4 stars.
4 stars. And Marie?
Well, my husband and I traveled through Nebraska in October doing a little R&R and antiquing and so on. And, I mean, he nailed it right here. You go off the beaten track into the small towns and nothing has changed. This is going to be one of my top 3 films of the year. Your focus is on Bruce Dern and Will Forte, and June Squibb is the Bruce Dern's wife. But the characters that surround it, that have been selected to make this town and make this film, every situation, every place they go, watch the characters around them. You almost have to see this one twice. There's 2 actors, Devin Rattray and Tim Dristle, who are 2 brothers. And there's a comedy scene in here where they try to pull off a mugging that is something out of Laurel and Hardy. So I'm going to give this a 4.
Okay, that's a 4 across the board for Nebraska, rated R. We have a few more titles we want to quickly get to. One is called The Best Man Holiday, which is a sequel to a film that came out over a decade ago. It's a story about a number of people who are college friends. They get together for the holiday, and then it's a very kind of soapy but sweet-natured story with a terrific cast that includes Taye Diggs and Morris Chestnut and Terrence Howard and some really terrific people. I just don't think that the script was quite up to the standards of the cast, Marie.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 3, but you need a roadmap to follow this because there's at least 10 main characters that interact with each other. But it follows the adventures of the first film, which came out about 12 years ago. So I'd give it a 3.
I'm right there with you. So that's a 3 for The Best Man Holiday. And also Black Nativity, rated PG, which is based upon Langston Hughes' famous play.
Yes, Langston Hughes' great sort of musical play came out in 1961, and this is not a film version of the Langston Hughes classic, but uses it as an inspiration. And it all makes for a very satisfying, if rather odd, mashup of inspired Langston Hughes' original musical drama and a 2013 hip-hop opera urban family melodrama. It's got a great cast. Forest Whitaker, who I learned because of this film started off as a professional opera singer. Who knew that?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then Angela Bassett, Jennifer Hudson, Mary Kay Blige. It's about a young boy that is sent to his grandparents, who's a very stern pastor, Forrest Whitaker, and his wife, Angela Bassett. He gets in trouble. It's a sort of cautionary tale, but everything gets solved because it's Christmas time and they're putting on the big church Christmas pageant.
Right.
Some of it is sort of static and ordinary as a movie, but the musical talent on display and its sincerity made me enjoy it immensely. Is it a bit corny? Yes. but so is Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life.
True enough.
So I'm going to give it 3.5 stars.
Okay. And, it's a musical soap opera. Let's face it. They've imposed this story on top of the musical nativity part. But great singing, great music, which saves the day.
Yeah, I'm with you guys, and I'm going to give it a 3.
Okay, I'm going to give it a 3 as well. So that's Black Nativity, rated PG. And I wanted quickly, Tom, for you to tell us a little bit about a movie called I Am Divine.
Yes, it seems like today that homosexuality, which used to be the love that dare not speak its name, is everywhere on Hollywood's screens.
We've talked about it a lot today.
Yes, right. This is a very funny and touching documentary that tells us the story of a little boy growing up in Baltimore who was bullied, the bullied gay kid who transforms himself with the help of his high school friend, John Waters, into Divine, the queen of filth herself.
Mm-hmm.
The legendary star of cult classics like Pink Flamingos, Female Trouble, Polyester, Lust in the Dust, and of course, the original Edna Turnblatt in
Hairspray.
It's a great, fun documentary that employs interviews by John Waters, Ricky Lake, Tab Hunter, Holly Woodland, and lots of archival footage of the Divine to celebrate the lasting influence on contemporary pop culture of our most outrageous and beloved drag queen ever. You'll laugh, I think you'll cry, and you'll have a hoot of a time. So I'm going to give it 3 stars.
Okay, that's 3 for I Am Divine. It's not rated. I would like to just quickly cover a movie called Out of the Furnace, which opens today. It's Christian Bale as a hardworking employee of a Pennsylvania steel mill. His life is upended after a night of drinking. He loses his girlfriend, hopes for the future, goes to jail. Things get worse when he gets back home. When his Iraqi war veteran brother gets into some illegal fist fighting, and then they wind up confronting this group of gangster hillbillies led by Woody Harrelson. It's sort of Deer Hunter light. It does touch on the same kind of themes, you know, with the Rust Belt industries dying away and the bad treatment given to returning war veterans and so on. And there's even a deer hunting scene, for crying out loud. Great cast, second-rate melodramatics. So I'm giving it a 2.5 out of 5 stars. And Marie, tell us about Homefront.
Homefront is, I'm going to give it a 2 for Jason Statham fans. You won't be disappointed, except with James Franco as the villain. He could have a mustache that he could twirl.
What's your rating?
2.
2 for Homefront. I want to thank my fellow movie critics, Tom Poe and Marie Asner. Central Standard returns on Monday with Nature in the City, a seasonal look at nature in and around the town. Stick around for Up to Date as they invite the DVD gurus in a discussion of journalism in cinema. Our show today was produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Ross Steinmetz, and our announcer is Michael Byers. I'm Russ Simmons. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your weekend.